everyone. This is Tom Regan. I'm a licensed addiction counselor and certified grief counselor for Heartview Foundation in Bismarck. Welcome to Recovery Chronicles. This is a weekly half-hour radio program that celebrates recovery from alcohol and drug addiction. And our guests are usually people who are in long-term recovery, and that applies today. And we welcome Corrine Carlin, very alliterative name. And not only is she a person in long-term recovery, but she happens to be a licensed addiction counselor, and she's been doing that for 24 years. So God bless you, and thanks for coming to the program.
Thank you, Tom.
And of course, as I told you, I'd like you to start, if you don't mind, please, with your own story of addiction and recovery. And where are you from, by the way?
I live here in Bismarck now.
Okay.
I grew up in small towns all over North Dakota.
Okay.
My father was in construction. We kind of followed that.
Sure. Sure.
So lots of new schools and.
Okay. So your story of addiction and recovery.
Okay. Well, I grew up in an alcoholic home. My father was an abusive alcoholic. Mm. I said, we moved frequently. I think I attended probably six schools during high school.
Yeah.
So we just did a lot of moving around.
That is moving around a lot.
Yeah. And I was, you know, it was the 70s. It was women's liberation and Vietnam War and just all that kind of havoc in the background. And I was very rebellious. Mm-hmm. I think I decided very early on that men were abusive and women ought not to take it. Mm-hmm. So as I was growing up, I was pretty certain that I could do whatever a man could do.
Mm-hmm.
And when I discovered alcohol, I was 12 years old and very clearly remember my first drink.
Really?
Very clearly. I had seven sevens at a friend's home.
Oh, my.
Her brother was home from college, and I guess he thought it was kind of fun to get the kids drunk. And it was like, wow, yeah. I really like this.
Sure. You know? You must have gotten sick. Come on now.
I threw up. Yeah, I threw up, but, you know. That didn't matter. That made room for more.
Yeah.
So by the time I was 13, I was smoking pot pretty much daily. That was really my drug of choice. Alcohol less so, but certainly I drank also.
Yes.
And by the time I was 18, I probably had tried probably every drug that was out there at the time, mm-hmm. with the exception of heroin. I don't know what it was, but that just, there was something there just sort of,
sure.
I never did that.
Yeah. Sometimes, as with me, and you know, we're roughly the same age. I might even have a couple of years on you, but the big H, I mean, mm-hmm. kind of, as you did, I tried so many drugs. Mm-hmm. But the big H was just kind of struck fear in my heart, you know.
Yeah.
I just, you heard about it. And so, and I'd also have to say that meth, you know, I hit the college campus in 1968, but meth also a kind of struck fear in my heart. You know, I met different meth addicts, and even by their appearance, it sort of gave me a proper fear, maybe. But that didn't keep me away from the alcohol and the cannabis, so... Anyway, go on.
Yeah. I guess I just sort of changed drugs, mm-hmm. like other people change clothes. You know, it was whatever today was going to bring. You know, if there was cross tops, then I did cross tops. And then, some pot to kind of take the edge off of that. And you could, I could drink a lot when I was using cross tops or Prelude 75s or whatever.
Yes.
And just kind of mixed and matched. I had no idea how dangerous that was, and I mixed and matched all the time.
Yeah.
So
you're lucky to be alive, for
yes,
one thing.
Yes, lucky to be alive in more ways than one.
Yeah.
As I said, you know, I think my dad had a big influence on me in that whole dynamic of, for some reason, it was stuck in my head that no man was ever going to tell me what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And also that women were underpaid.
Yes.
So when I was 18, I worked as a nanny for a while, and then I went to school to be a heavy equipment operator. And I did work in that field for a few years.
For equal pay?
Equal pay. Okay. It was great. It was great. So I got good pay, but I spent it all.
You know,
very rapidly. I didn't really save any money. I went to work at a coal mine, and I did that for a couple years. I got married in 1979, and I had a child in 1980, a child in 1983, and I continued to use through those pregnancies. I found when I went to treatment, one of the things that I discovered was during both of my pregnancies, I was trying not to smoke pot. I was trying not to use. I didn't drink at all. But I used pot, you know, less than I had been, but still I was using pot.
Yes.
And kind of kept myself in a state of withdrawal, I think, throughout my pregnancies.
Yes.
So that was kind of miserable. And as a sideline, both of my children have learning disabilities. And I don't have proof that that's a causal kind of thing, but I certainly feel as if it is a huge part of that. In 1984, I had a stroke. And at that time...
Really at a very young age.
I had a stroke. And at that time, they didn't really know why, why that happened. But what they told me was... You know, my doctor said, of course, you know, if you drink alcohol, only ever have one, because more than that can hurt you. Of course, they had data, research data to show that. But they didn't really know a lot about pot at that time. And he said, if you smoke the wacky, just don't.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, of course, I told him that I would never
do
that. You know, not me.
Yeah.
And for the next 6 months, I had a therapist who came into my home to do speech therapy and physical therapy. And I worked hard at that every day. I practiced every day. And then I would have a couple tokes at night. And everything that I had gained during the day regarding control over my muscles would be gone.
Interesting,
You know, almost immediately. That was insane. That was completely insane.
Sure.
For the next couple of years, I continued to do that. You know, I continued to kind of make progress and make change. I had to reinvent myself. I couldn't do, I couldn't work at the mine anymore. I couldn't do that kind of work anymore. So I reinvented myself and went to work in an office and learned to type, which I do very strangely because my hands float. And at night I would smoke pot I started drinking again. I used to do this thing where I really didn't like myself when I drank, because when I drink, I mean, it's like, I call it being a snaky drunk. It's like, I'm having a good time, you know, just life at the party. And then in the flip of an instant, I'm just angry and rageful and mean. So I didn't really like myself when I drank. I reminded myself very much of my father.
I see.
And so I would promise myself, I'm not going to do that. And I'm only going to smoke pot because, you know, it's an herb.
Right.
It's all natural and it certainly won't hurt me.
It's provided by Mother Nature.
All that crazy kind of thinking. I had all that going on. But in the 70s and 80s in North Dakota, there were times when you just couldn't find pot where you lived. And then I would be at the bar, of course, you know, drinking and.
Right.
Kind of getting in trouble with folks because I couldn't keep my mouth shut and I would be so nasty. what kind of happened to me is I owned my own business. I was in a partnership and I had developed my own job. You know, it was, I developed the job. It was what I had been doing for a couple of years already. And I became so anxious. I had so much free-floating fear, paranoia, anxiety, that I would go to the work in the morning and I would close the door to my office and take the phone off the hook, because I knew I couldn't handle anybody looking at me or talking to anyone on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
So really, when I went to treatment, a few of my friends had cleaned up and gone to treatment, and I called one of them. He was at Heartview, and I called him, and I said, do they lock the doors there?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, no, I can leave anytime I want
yes.
to. So I thought about that because I knew that one day somebody was going to look at me and they were going to see how crazy I was. I felt like I was just completely off the rails.
Mm-hmm.
I knew I was addicted to pot, but I really didn't think that was a problem. I just thought, yeah, well, you know, it's natural.
Right.
But right. what it gave me was this idea that I could go to Heartview and kind of hang out and calm down and not have to look at anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was an addict, I had no problem with that, but I knew I was really mentally ill, that was really my problem, is that, you know, this anxiety.
Right.
So.
And it was mostly anxiety. Was it anxiety and depression or just kind of pure anxiety?
It was anxiety, yeah, just I this see. Free yeah. floating fear, this
yes.
knot in my gut that would come and go without seemingly any good reason.
Right, right.
I just kind of was falling apart on the inside.
Mm-hmm.
When I got to treatment, lo and behold, I first of all went through withdrawal, and it is not pleasant to sit on the nurse's desk and watch snakes crawl
yes.
around on the carpet,
mm-hmm.
Even though I knew this is not real,
yeah.
it's still there, and I still wouldn't right. put my feet on the floor.
Right.
So.
Wow. Now, was that considered withdrawal from cannabis or from alcohol?
Alcohol
or both? I see. Okay. From alcohol primarily,
mm-hmm.
yes.
Alcohol.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
So by that time, you had also become
a
heavy drinker.
Yeah. Okay. I was an alcoholic.
Yeah.
When I wasn't doing one, I was doing the other.
So when did you finally turn the corner? You know, when did you finally see the light and make up your mind that...
You know, I was in treatment for 35 days. And
yes.
every one of those days, I said several times a day, I'm Coco and I'm an alcoholic addict.
Right.
And the words came out my mouth, but they didn't really settle in my heart.
Yes.
I had a counselor who was just this wonderful old dragon.
Uh-huh.
And she said, oh, you drunks, you always want the easier, softer way.
Yes.
And she thought that for me, and she told me that for me, that idea of, oh, I'm going crazy was much easier to accept than I'm an alcoholic,
I see.
Just like my dad.
I see. Yeah.
And I thought she was crazy.
And there was probably a lot of wisdom in that.
Well, yeah. by the time I finished treatment, I knew for sure that I was an alcoholic. And the amazing thing, what convinced me, I guess, is that after 35 days, I didn't feel crazy anymore.
Wow.
I didn't have a lot of anxiety. That was gone.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I believe with the withdrawal and just kind of getting a few weeks away from my last drink and my last drug.
Right.
The anxiety kind of disappeared.
Amazing. Amazing.
So,
you know, and you know this as an addiction counselor. Not many people know that quitting alcohol or that withdrawal from alcohol is one of the most dangerous withdrawal experiences. It can kill you. I mean, with going into seizure and such. So,
I'm very grateful that I didn't have to experience that, and that I had a place to go where I could. You know, I didn't even know about that at that time. I mean,
sure.
I didn't know anything.
Yes,
I actually went to Heartview with an appointment apparently for an evaluation. I didn't know anything about anything at that time. Well, I came with my suitcase, you know, in my hand, and had this evaluation and. It's like, I'm ready to go.
Yeah.
You know, I'm ready to just move in here. And I had to first be accepted. My insurance had to approve all of those kinds
sure.
of things.
So
fortunately, I'd had a few drinks before I went.
Yes.
And that was the only reason I got to stay. I had a managed care plan at that time, and they wanted me to leave for 3 days and come back with my doctor's approval and all of those kinds of things.
Sure.
And because I was intoxicated when I got there, and I was, you know, showed up intoxicated saying, I want treatment.
Yeah.
My insurance had to pay for me to stay.
I see. Little did you know
I didn't know anything.
That qualified you. So now is this when Heartview was in Mandan on the hill?
Heartview was a campus over there. And, you know, they didn't lock the door, and I didn't even get into my first group for about a week and a half. I spent well over the first week walking in circles in front of the front door, convincing myself that I really didn't want to walk out the door.
Yes. Wow.
You know, I just kept, that obsession was so strong. It was just, I can leave anytime I want. And I spent a lot of time doing that.
So did that first treatment stick? Did it stick?
Well, it kind of stuck.
Yeah.
I cleaned up in 1986.
Yes.
And in 1996, I actually used a pot on a weekend, and it terrified me.
Yes.
I ran back to my recovery friends as quickly as I could, told them about it, just like sobbing about it, because it struck terror of, you know, I did this before and I couldn't stop. You know, so just that being honest with my friends about this is what happened. And then I kind of redoubled my efforts to not,
Well, good for you.
Relapse again.
Good for you, you know, and what I like to say is they couldn't take all that time in recovery away from you either. I mean,
no, I knew what to do.
Yeah. I mean, and people also say that, you know, once you've been in treatment, you know, you can never drink again or never use again, and have fun, you know, because you're always going to have a guilty conscience, and you're always going to know that you're doing the wrong thing because now you know that you are, an addict. So,
When I left treatment in 1986, my counselor, who was Jean Lillis, told me, you know, you can go ahead and drink if you want to, but you're going to see my face in the bottom of every glass. And I just thought, you know, I believe that. I haven't had a drink since, and I believe that could happen.
Now, for you, was your recovery a spiritual awakening? You know,
very much so. It's been a process throughout the years, you know, that just continues to grow and to be more obvious to me.
Sure.
You know, those spiritual connections, it just continues to grow.
Yes.
I lived in a small town, and I needed to access people who were in recovery. I accessed community supports to help me stay clean and sober.
Yeah.
And, you know, it seems as if the people that I needed in my life have been put in my life.
Yes.
You know, I had a mentor, a recovery mentor at one time who was, there were no women around with more recovery than I had.
Yes.
So this gentleman was my mentor, and he was an older Catholic, probably Republican, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But, you know, that very conservative, staunch, whereas I still had that liberation idea going on in my head. So I would go and see him, and we met at his home where his wife was also there.
Yes.
And he would tell me truths that I didn't want to hear. And he would say, go, you know, go do that. Go try that out. Yeah. And I would grumble all the way home about, you know, male chauvinist and blah, blah, blah. But I would do what he told me to do.
Well,
and son of a gun, it seemed like it worked.
You got results.
I got results. I stayed sober.
Yeah.
Those people just have been placed in my life.
You know, as a counselor, as an addiction counselor, I often say to patients, especially when I'm delivering the lecture, but I say that since I'm in long-term recovery, I often say we who are in recovery now have the personal responsibility to be on a lifelong program of self-improvement. I mean, those, and we can't afford to take a step backwards. We have to be so conscious every day of where we are mentally, physically, emotionally, spiritually, and I'm sure that that you you agree with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, my experience with smoking pot that day really brought that home to me in the 90s when I did that. Because it was, I didn't intend to do that. I put myself in a place with people and never thought about, oh, yeah, well, pot might be there. I just never even thought about that.
Right.
So I wasn't taking care of myself. I wasn't aware of what was happening around me until, boom, there it is.
Yes.
And
that's right.
I didn't think about it twice. I mean, I did not think about it twice.
That's why I love the saying, if you hang around the barber shop long enough, you're going to get a haircut, you know. And I told someone the other day, and you know, this really concerns me, and I'd like your take on it, but my drugs of choice were cannabis and alcohol, and usually in combination. So, but I told someone the other day, I really could never live in Denver today, or other cities and states, I'm sure, because I verified this with someone who has recently lived in Denver. I said, so what happens when you go to events, when in particular outdoor events? He said, well, you smell pot all the time. Mm-hmm. And so knowing myself, I know I could not live there because it would be too risky to expose myself to that. Mm-hmm. Have you heard that?
I've not heard that, but I've thought about that. Even here in Bismarck, you know, sometimes when there's street fairs and things like that, there'll be a beer garden.
Yes.
And, you know, you're just kind of walking by and you get that whiff of pot, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, or beer. Yeah.
Well, the beer is less of a trigger for me, I think. For whatever reason, the smell of beer is less of a trigger for me than the smell of pot. Even today, even after all of these years, when I smell pot, my mouth waters.
Yeah.
My only response is that I have to turn around and walk away.
I know. I hear you. Yeah. I mean, and this is the way I put it. Unfortunately, I enjoyed the smell of it. And a lot of people say, how can you like that? But I had a plan once upon a time, to make a long story short, I went to a concert a few years ago, and I had a plan. And it was a rock a rock concert. And I had a plan. I thought, well, what if I smell pot next to me or behind me or in front of me? And my plan was to get up and walk out. I mean, that's the kind of planning that we're talking about here. So... and I should say our guest is Corrine Carlin, and she's a person in long-term recovery, and she's a licensed addiction counselor. So what's your best advice to your patients? I mean, what do you think is some of that golden advice as to, okay, how do I enter recovery and how do I stay there?
I think, I don't know what they would tell you, but I think just, you know, get involved in those community supports.
Yeah.
Be honest and don't use, hang in, hang on, and, you know, look for those folks who have some recovery and hang on tight to them.
Yeah.
Because they've been there, done that, and they can help.
And sometimes the way we put that is stick with the winners, you know, not the, identify the winners and stick with them, because the losers, they'll just bring you down, and misery loves company, I guess, is another another phrase we use, find out who your real friends are, and then stick with them.
Yep, and know that you're worth it.
Right.
You know, just know that you're worth it. It's hard. Recovery is hard work, and it kind of gets easier over the years, but it's still hard work. We still have to be guarded and be aware of who we're with and where we're at and what might happen in that setting.
Yeah.
And just make choices about where, you know, where do I go?
Always, yeah.
You know, if I happen to walk into a bar tonight because my brother's playing in a band, that's one thing. But if I walk in a bar every night and just sit at the stool and have a soda because I think I can, I'm going to be drinking.
Sure.
You know, I truly believe that. I can't hang around too long before I'm going to be using whatever's there.
It's the barbershop thing again, you know. I mean, that's just no place for us to be. And I'm sorry the time is going so fast. We've got about 4 minutes left, you know. But go ahead. Yeah,
I'd like to say you asked me about spirituality and the spirituality of the program of my recovery. I think one of the best things I've seen out of my recovery is that I was always in conflict with my father as I was growing up. I avoided him in my young adulthood. And as a recovering person, as he was elderly, I was able to go and spend time with him and love him and care about him and be the best daughter that I wow. could be.
Yeah. That's wonderful.
You know, and forgive him and forgive myself for yeah. the way I had treated him, because I was no sweet yeah. little princess when I was young either.
Sure.
So that was one of the biggest rewards of my program.
Yeah. What a wonderful you know, story. Yeah. Yeah. And I feel my parents were, they were so worried about me. They knew I was in trouble. My first, my journey to recovery began when I was 28 years old, 29. And I am so glad that they were able to see that, that I finally was, you know, sought help and was able to, you know, able to turn things around. So what a great story. So for people, one of the missions of this program of Recovery Chronicles is to, help people find help, you know, and to give people hope. So if mm-hmm. someone may be listening right now and they know they're in trouble, what can they do or what should they do? What's the first step?
Ask for help.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly they can. There are multiple support groups in this town. Mm-hmm. There's AA, there's NA, there's Celebrate Recovery.
Yes.
There are churches who open their doors and open their arms to people who need help.
Mm-hmm.
There's ministry on the margins and just access for help through all kinds of.
Sure. Talk to your minister.
Yep.
Talk to your family practitioner.
There are Heartview and New Freedom Center and West Central Human Service Center. There are
right.
all kinds of facilities where you can just call.
Yes. You got to make that call.
Yep. Just making that call or reaching out to somebody who lives across the hall who you know is in recovery.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be something really formal. It's just.
Yeah. And say, how do you do it? I want what you have. What's your secret?
Mm-hmm.
It's usually the way something gets started, you know.
Yeah. And so, I'm really excited right yeah. now because we do have new things happening in our community. There's more of that community spirit of let's step up. Let's be a community. Let's
True.
Treat recovery like a community
and let's treat it like a disease
mm-hmm. and like a disease
yeah.
and not like there's something wrong with us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're not
no
bad.
Stigma.
We're yeah. not bad people. We're good people who happen right. to have a disease.
Right.
And we're either practicing or we're not practicing.
Yeah. And we're, and there's a new epidemic today, you know,
mm-hmm.
which is the opioids. And every time you pick up a newspaper or a magazine or even listen to the radio, this is what you hear about. So I'm sure you'd agree with me as an addiction counselor. It's maybe never been more of an emergency, really.
An emergency, but, you know, I think the good news is, and mm-hmm. maybe, the, you know, not only as an addiction counselor, but as a recovering person, people recover. I mean, recovery is possible, and it's good. I've heard it said over and over that, oh, geez, people just can't recover from meth. That's not true. That's a myth. I'm not sure why it's perpetuated. Methamphetamine users certainly can recover and do recover. And so
yeah.
can heroin addicts. And so
yes.
can, you know, prescription opiate addicts. Recovery is possible.
There you go. Let's end with that. Recovery is possible. And so our guest today, Corrine Carlin. Thank you so much. I mean, and traditionally we close with the serenity prayer. So let's do that. God, grant me the serenity
to accept
the things I cannot change.
The courage to change
the things
I can.
And
the wisdom
to know
the
difference. Thank you.
I sing the song because I love the man. I know that some of you don't understand. Milk blood to keep from running out. I've seen the